Good morning, everyone. I hope you all slept very well. Certainly some of you got woken up by the panrhythmia exercises and everything, which was very nice to see so many of you there. It's a huge pleasure to welcome Lucy King here. She's come further than anybody else to be at the conference, having, as she told you yesterday, flown in from Kenya yesterday morning. She's here really because of my involvement in the St. Andrews Prize for the Environment, which is a joint venture between the University of St. Andrews and ConocoPhillips. And I was asked by Sir Crispin Tickell a couple of years ago to become a trustee. And it's an absolutely fascinating job because there are projects put in from all around the world. And then the final three people get invited to St. Andrews for quite a grilling and a presentation of their projects. And Lucy was the winner a couple of years ago of this very prestigious prize. And it's something, it always helps the projects take it to the next level. So standrewsprize.org, if you're interested. Patron is the Prince of Wales. And last year was the 15th. Year of prizes, and so I'm going up there a week after next for the next one. And you'll see here the most beautiful photograph. Lucy has a DPhil, and that identifies you as an Oxford person, because no other university has DPhils, they only have PhDs. So if you want to be really ahead of the game, then DPhil is what have after your name, including Eddie Billimoria. Our very own Eddie Billimoria here has a DPhil. Maybe anybody else in... No, well, it's any very exclusive club. Ah, yes, we have another. Good. Anyway, I'm not going to take any more of Lucy's time. I thought her project was incredibly innovative and interesting. And you'll learn quite a lot about elephants and her work this morning. So warm welcome, Lucy. Thank you very much for coming all this way.
Well, thank you very much. It's really a great honour to be here to meet you all and to partake in this very interesting conference. It's probably one of the more unusual conferences I've spoken at. And I can see from the agenda that my topic is rather different to the ones that follow. So I hope I can incorporate my work with elephants and bees and people in Africa into this whole conference looking at harmony and harmony in nature. And I'd like to start off with about a 40-minute talk, and then at the end I've got a very small video just to show you. My colleagues from Disney have just emailed me the latest video we've done on our project, and it's only 5 minutes, and it came in last night, so I just downloaded it on the wireless internet in the hotel. So I thought I'd premiere my our short 5-minute video today at the end. So that's very exciting. And yes, I do like to start with this beautiful photograph. This is taken in the river just by our research camp up in Sambru, where I did my PhD work. And it really embodies everything that we're trying to do at Save the Elephants, trying to have beautiful elephants living in a beautiful, pristine environment with compact, contacted families, with tusks that haven't been cut out, and being able to live with a sort of natural swirl of the environment. So this is a very inspiring photo for me, and really what we're aiming to towards. And I know some of you will have heard all the latest news about elephants recently, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about my PhD work first, and then it rolls into the project work that I'm doing at the moment. And Save the Elephants, just to give you a little update in case you're not aware of our organisation, was founded by Dr. Ian Douglas Hamilton, who was the real pioneer of elephant research in the 1960s and 70s. This is him doing his PhD in Manyara in Tanzania. And he was really the first scientist to discover that elephants lived in families. And this seems extraordinary today, but no one had actually studied them and spent time with them. And he really spent an incredible amount of incredible, intense time with his elephants. He got to know them very well. He got to walk among them. There was one particular elephant he got so familiar with called Virgo that he actually ended up walking with her a few times, and she became very connected with him. Occasionally he made a mistake and got the wrong elephant. So, you know, we're not all perfect. This actually was Boadicea, who chased him for several kilometres until he climbed this tree. So, you know, this is our founder of Save the Elephants, and we learn a lot from him, and he really is my mentor still today. So he founded Save the Elephants in 1995, we moved up to our main research camp. But this is a map of Kenya to give you a taster of where our elephants are. It's a very, very large country, and we have elephants in around 25% of the country. The green areas are where the elephants are. So we have a very three main populations that we deal with. The Samburu Laikipia ecosystem at the top, which has around 7,500 elephants. We have the massive Tsavo ecosystem, Tsavo Amboseli to the south, which is around 12,500. And then we have the Masai Mara Serengeti population to the left, which we share with Tanzania. And Save the Elephants has projects, not surprisingly, in almost all of these core elephant areas. And I particularly work in our two main sites, which is Samburu Laikipia at the top, which is where my PhD work was conducted. And in Tsavo, in that small white spot in between Tsavo East and Tsavo West. So I'll be leading up and telling you more about that more recent research. Samburu in the north is a very, very special place. I don't know if any of you have had the privilege of going up to Samburu land. It is the most stunning wild vista you can see. I mean, this is really a stunning image. And in this area, traditionally, this is a pastoralist area. So people migrate through the landscape with their cattle, and they move from place to place as the seasons change. And this is how Africa has been for millennia. And it's incredibly compatible with wildlife because, of course, the cattle can move as the seasons grow. They walk around the elephants. The elephants really don't mind cattle and people. Elephants are not wanting to eat or kill people. So long as you're walking gently with them, you can walk and exist in the same environment. And this is the Africa of old. And it's only really in the last 100 years that Africa has changed so dramatically. But this is how people have lived with elephants for millennia and millennia until this century. And in Samburu, where we work, it's almost a utopia, really, for elephants. It's quite well protected. We have these beautiful elephant families that we're allowed to study, and we spend a great deal of time just observing them. This is our research camp up in Samburu. It's my little tent, just to show you. We were talking about tents last night and living in tents and how connected you can become with the environment by living with the environment you're studying all the time. And this is completely unfenced. We had elephants wandering around almost every day in our camp. So this was my home for 3.5 years. So I became absorbed, started my work in 2006, really became absorbed with the team up there. All of the researchers are Samburu warriors who've been trained to study the elephants. And they know instinctively more than we do because they've been brought up with them. They live with these animals. So we learn a lot from them. They may learn our techniques and science and recording and methods, all very sort of strict methods, but they tell us so much more about what we're observing and how to walk and observe these incredible animals. And the Samburu believe absolutely with no doubt that they are from the same clan as elephants. So they have a very great respect. They'd never eat elephant meat. That would be just like eating your ancestors. And if they ever come across a dead elephant in the field, they will break off branches and put bright green leaves in amongst the elephant orifices in their mouths and ears and often in their cut-off faces to show respect to their ancestors. So this is a really special place to work and study elephants because of that connectivity with the people and the pastoralists in that area. So the bottom right-hand photo is a lot of the elephants come down to the river in Samburu. This is the Owasso Nero River. It's actually quite a dry photograph in this one. And the river is very wide. It's the central point of Samburu National Reserve. And this is what we actually call a beach party, where lots of elephants come down from different clans. They come, all these different kinship groups join up, and you have maybe 5 or 6 families there with a few bulls in the middle. And this is fascinating. You can sit there for hours watching this. They're playing, they're fighting, they're chatting, they're gossiping, they're mating, they're rolling in the mud. And this is how elephant societies develop. And they're very, very complex, very interesting, and we've got our project's been there for 20 years now, really unraveling how these elephants live. And to help that, we have these identification sheets. So we have over 800-900 elephants ID'd now. Our main researchers, I know every single elephant, just like you know your dogs and cats and horses. So just an example of our ID sheet, this is Rodan, a lovely female from the artist family. She has a code, R23. And you see we have a left-hand ear photo, a right ear photo, and then a full facial. So she's very distinctive, little holes in the ear, small tusks, little rip in the top right-hand ear. So we can tell her a mile off, and this is how we get to identify the elephants. Very, very interesting. The older they get, the more rips and cuts and holes they have. So the older matriarchs really have dramatic stories to tell, So this is Mellifera. There's no doubt who she is. We can spot her about 10 miles off. She's got this ginormous rip in her right ear. We can't ever know how that happened, but it's likely that as a calf, her ear got slit by a passing branch, maybe running away from something. And as she's grown, the slit has grown with her. So she probably wasn't cut like that as an adult. This is probably a growth defect from when she was young. So one of the ways we study elephants is by putting collars around them. This is a tracking collar. We've collared in the last 20 years over 360 elephants across four biomes in Africa, Gabon, Mali, South Africa, Kenya, and it's really a fascinating tool. These collars may look quite invasive, but they really aren't. They're about 0.5% of the body weight of the elephant, so they can hardly feel these collars. And in that top unit you can see just above the neck is a SIM card from a mobile phone. And it simply sends us a text message every hour of the GPS position of that elephant. The message comes through the mobile phone system. It embeds onto our cell phones if we want to record that elephant, or it goes straight into a computer network. And it gives us an hourly position of where all our elephants are at any one time. We can remotely change these. So if we see an elephant approaching a farm, or we see an elephant approaching a very dangerous area, we can change it to a 15-minute interval. So every 15 minutes, we can see how that elephant's moving. Fascinating for research if you're looking at micro movements of elephants in response to changes in the environment. So I spent quite a lot of time helping collar these elephants during my PhD as part of assisting the whole Save the Elephants team. And in particular, I was interested in looking at elephants that had been collared that live near farming areas. This is a very famous bull and elephant in Kenya called Mountain Bull. He lived on the slopes of Mount Kenya. This is a Google Earth image. And every single red dot that you can see there is 1 hour of his life. So you don't have to be a scientist to say that that's obviously his home area. He's an intense home area of that forest. It's called the Amenti Forest. It's a beautiful forest on the slopes of Mount Kenya, protected, beautiful trees, all sorts of other animals. We have bongos living there. It's a really stunning place. But about 10 or 11 times a year, Mountain Bull leaves this harmony and haven of a place and decides to zoom through these farming areas to another forest below, to the Ngari Dari Forest, where he hangs out for about a week, and then he'll go back again into his main forested area. So this is an active decision to go through these farming sites. And as you see what we call streaking crop raiding here, that is all of those lines of one night. So he won't hang out in those farms in the day. It'll just be one night of movement, crop raiding all the way through those farms, breaking fences, and then pops out at 6 a.m. in another safe forest where he hangs out for a few days. And then he prepares himself and he zooms back and he crop raids all the way back. So you can imagine these farmers are getting pretty irate at this, and he's breaking fences, and he's broken one fence so often that the landowner actually put a gate so that he unlatched the gate every time and walked through, and then he would leave it. So they thought that was more preferable than him breaking the gate every time. So, these elephants are incredibly characterful. So this is actually what it looks like on the ground. This is actually not Mountain Bull, but there's another elephant in there with an elephant collar on called Genghis Khan. And he was called Genghis Khan because he's without doubt the most notorious crop raider in northern Kenya. He is training 17 other bulls here how to crop raid. So we put a collar on him because this is fascinating behavior. He's got 17 followers. And so when we look at that GPS point on a map, it's not just him. He's representing a whole movement of elephants trying to work out how to crop raid. And this is pretty terrifying if you're that little farmer living in a mud hut. Those elephants could just walk through your house without even sort of noticing. They are ginormous pachyderms, up to 7 tons per individual. So this is very scary. And one of our programs is called geofencing. So electronically, we put a tag system on his collar. So as soon as Genghis enters an area which is represented by a GPS coordinate, not by a fence, we get a text message saying that elephant has entered this farming area, be aware. And of course, what you can do is send those text messages to farmers, you can send them to managers, to rangers, and you can get people to get in cars and drive them back out. So this is an incredible tool for managing individual conflict situations. And so this is something called geofencing, and people are now using it all over Africa. And it started up with our team, particularly really to look at conflict and elephants moving into danger areas. And this is actually what happens on the ground. So elephants that break into people's farms, there's incredible damage, either trampling of crops, breaking through fences, breaking over of trees, ripping up everything. And if you have 18 elephants in your farm in a night, you can literally lose the entire harvest. So this is devastating, particularly for farmers living on less than a dollar a day. We use that phrase, a dollar a day. If some of my farmers were earning a dollar a day, that would be, you know, gold dust for them. They're earning about 10 cents a day, these guys. So this is devastating. We talk to school kids as well, and we get the kids to explain to us what they're seeing at night time. We get a lot of information from talking to children. So they draw what they're experiencing, and they tell us, you know, mum banging an iron sheet, there's dogs barking, there's babies under the elephant kind of learning how to crop raid. So we have these amazing whole books of kids' drawings of what they experience at night. So, of course, what ends up is we have, you know, severe injuries that happen to our elephants. We have the horrendous photo on the top left of spears being hurled at elephants, sticking out of their head, elephants collapsing. And this is the KWS vets, Kenya Wildlife Service, trying to get this spear out of this elephant's temple. This elephant has not died from that wound, but it's incredibly angry. So if you let an elephant wander around with a spear in their head and they see another human the next day, they're going to kill that person immediately. So the aggression builds up between both sides. And this is very vicious. And of course, as time has progressed, we've gone from spears and arrows to AK-47s and M16s. And we're now getting elephants being gunshot down. And I'm afraid this is what we're now seeing, is just this absolute, you know, horrendous scene of elephants being shot out. Often their legs are shot out beneath them. We know every single one of these elephants. The elephant on the top right is called Enthusiasm, and we're almost 99% sure that her face was shorn off with a log cutter, an electric saw, while she was still alive. So, you know, they shot out her legs, she collapsed, and they come up on a motorbike and just go and saw off her face and then throw it on a motorbike and off they go. So this is the kind of thing we're seeing, and it's just not acceptable. So in order to try and combat this, we've got to really come up with some different solutions. And it has such a great impact on elephant society. When you lose that key individual, that matriarch, that bull from the kinship that we're talking about, there's a whole person that's lost from that network. Elephants grieve, and they can grieve for many, many months. And when there's constant death within the family, it actually disrupts the whole network. And that's when you end up having delinquency within elephants. If you lose those key matriarchs who know where the dry water season holes are, they know where to go and feed in the dry season, they know which rivers are safe to cross with their babies, then you lose that generation of knowledge. So losing key individuals is very, very critical for living with elephants, because the delinquency that we're seeing in some of these countries is now very serious. And the more lack of leadership these elephants have, the more crop raiding that happens, the more anger towards people. You get bulls stampeding through villages now, just killing people for no apparent reason because of this aggression that's built up. And as we all know, elephants have phenomenal memories. And unfortunately, a lot of this is being driven by demand from the Far East, from the ivory demands that we can't seem to abate. China's growing wealth has really increased demand. We had a ludicrous sale of ivory in 2008 from the southern African countries that's triggered this massive poaching outbreak. And we're losing tens and tens of thousands of elephants a year. Our latest paper from Save the Elephants showed we've lost 100,000 elephants in the last 3 years. So we're on a steep decline, and Kenya's the least worst hit at the moment because of our intense work with the Wildlife Service and all of our different NGOs, but the Tanzania's lost 50,000 elephants from one game park alone in 5 years. So the Selu National Park has basically been decimated in the last 5 years. They used to have 72,000 elephants in 2006, and there's 13,000 left. So Tanzania is really on the downward spiral. So what do we do about this? Well, this is what we could do. This is what I call the South African option, where you just stick up a load of electric fences everywhere. And this is what South Africa does. They divide people from wildlife. They shore up their national parks like fortress conservation. They keep people out so no one can go and collect firewood or do anything at all. And they keep elephants in. And quite frankly, it's a total disaster. The elephant population is exploding. They're now having to resort to contraceptive methods. They're even talking about opening culling again in South Africa, can you believe, in the middle of this poaching outbreak, because they've concentrated elephants in a little environment. They're also knocking trees down. They're causing havoc. I've just spent 2 weeks in Kruger being taken on as a consultant to try and stop elephants knocking their trees down with beehives, because they've just basically shut them all up into these parks. So this is not the solution in my eyes at all. This is just a temporary reduction in conflict, but it leads to huge problems in the future. So this is actually a fence from Kenya, which they tried to put in across Laikipia, right across our study area. Absolutely horrified by this fence that went up. This was done by the Dutch government and the Kenyan government as a sort of, you know, solution to stop farmers losing the vote, basically. And within 2 months, this is what happened. So our elephants were very nonplussed by this enormous barrier and just decided that's a ridiculous thing to do. So they just walked straight through it. And those are two of our collared elephants you can see. So, you know, this hasn't worked at all in Kenya. We have huge bulls. They're used to their migration corridors. And in Swahili, we actually don't have a word for maintenance. It doesn't exist in the language. So, of course, when that fence broke, that was it. It was never repaired. It was pretty quickly, the whole thing is knocked down and it's a disaster. So at Save the Elephants, I'm more interested in looking at natural solutions. And how do we go back to understanding the elephants themselves and how elephants actually crop raid, why they crop raid, what are they doing, and how do we look for solutions using more natural solutions? And one thing we do know from some previous work by my supervisor and Ian was that elephants can actually break open natural beehives as they're foraging in trees. And they did a small study that observed that acacia trees with beehives in were less foraged on than trees without beehives in. So this was published in a very obscure German journal that no one ever read. But I read it, and I thought this was a really fascinating concept that we could have, elephants could know about bees and avoid trees that had beehives in. And from talking to lots of people and collecting anecdotes for my thesis, it turns out that bees can sting elephants. They get stung up the trunk, around the watery areas of the eyes and in the mouth, behind the ears. Some parts of their skin are thin enough, like on the elbows of their legs. And young calves have definitely got thin enough skins to be stung. So the female elephants would be very wary about having a beehive near any of their young calves. So we know that elephants can get stung by bees. So in order to study this for my PhD, it was quite challenging. You know, how do you get wild African bees, which are very dangerous? And how do you get wild elephants, which are 7 tons and you can't move either of them? And how do you study the interaction when they never see each other? So it was quite a challenge for my thesis. And I thought, you know, in order to get the two together, I have to also not be killed in the process of moving elephants and bees. So I thought the best way was just to simply record the sound of the bees first. So we set up a whole microphone system and recorded very angry bees. I made them angry by throwing stones into their hive. And they erupted into my microphone and got a fantastic, really angry, vicious recording of bees attacking my microphone. And then we played it back through a wireless speaker system. So this is a fake tree trunk that we built. And inside that hole is a little wireless speaker. And then we placed that in the bushes near elephants. And then we drove quite some distance away, and I could drive up to 80 to 100 meters away from the speaker, and then quietly film their reaction from a great distance in order to sort of get their natural response. You can't play back sounds like this from your car, because otherwise they look up and they see a human and they're like, oh, humans are weird, there's some weird sound coming out. So you have to displace yourself as a researcher from the speaker. So I'm just going to show you 1 minute of three different video clips of how our elephants reacted to bee sounds. So here we have a family resting very happily under a tree with a nice bull underneath, and the speaker system is hidden on the left. And now you can start to hear the bee sound coming out of the bushes, and as they listen and react, they all start backing off very quickly, including that huge bull in the middle. And then it's hidden again on the right-hand side in those bushes. Again, another very large bull in the middle. And as they hear this sound, they back off very quickly and they go all together in the opposite, always in the opposite direction to the bee sound, and always very swiftly. This is a slightly slower reaction. You can see the females lifting up their heads, putting their ears out, trying to locate the sound. There's lots of trunk flicking going on. There's a young calf underneath that they kick in the second to say, come and get up, there's a problem. And then one of these females triggers a retreat. And she causes the other elephants to follow her. And this is critical to this idea that they all go together as a family. And as they listen and they digest what it is they're hearing, they actually start picking up speed and start running. And, you know, this is... you feel slightly guilty for about 2 seconds when you do this because they were very happy under that tree. But what this showed us is that elephants hearing bee sounds... travel a great distance away in order to escape that sound. And of course, we're in this situation, we only play this once to elephants, so they have no idea that that's not bees. This is just their instant reaction, that they think there are bees coming out of the bush. So the distance moved was very significant compared to our control sound of white noise. We also did a second experiment for this with my colleagues from Disney. This is the first year that my partnership with the Disney Animal Kingdom developed, with Dr. Joseph Soltis. He's been out with me for 8 years now, and he's a bioacoustician. So he came and helped me place these very high-sensitive microphones around the elephants. This is an Earthworks microphone. Some of you might know them from orchestras. They record down to 3 hertz, so this is perfect for recording elephant infrasonic rumbles. And by placing these microphones around the elephants, we repeated the experiment, and it turns out that they were actually communicating to each other in infrasonic rumbles as they heard bee sounds. Not only did they start rumbling more as they heard bee sounds, but even once the bee sounds had stopped — this is the pre-stimulus, the stimulus phase and the post-stimulus phase — actually, when the bee sounds had stopped, they started communicating even more. And it turned out that they were rumbling to each other that there was a threat in the area. And other elephants in the area would then come and join them, and they would all move off together. I mean, this was absolutely fascinating. So elephants we didn't even know were there, you know, suddenly started materializing and joining them and going off together. So they appeared to be communicating about a threat in their environment. And when we analyzed that particular rumble that was coming out from these microphones — you cannot hear these rumbles, so this is all done through computers — it looks at the second formant created, which is one of the structural sort of systems in the vocalization, was elevated when in response to bees. And this is different to when we played control sounds to them. They did rumble occasionally because they were wandering off, and they might just be communicating to each other saying, "Oh, we're off," or "Come and join us." But it was a different type of rumble. It's a different type of communication amongst these elephants. Additionally, they head shook a lot. So this suggests that they're wanting to flick the bees out of the air as they're running away. So all in all, this is a whole load of data and information telling us these elephants know exactly what they're listening to. They understand that that's a bee. They don't want bees near them. They know they're going to be stung around the face and the neck. They head shake, they run, they tell each other to get out of the area. And this is really important sort of understanding of their consciousness about a threat to them. So we were able to publish some of our work in Current Biology, which I'm lucky to get the front cover for that. And then we've also published, you know, more and more details about how these bee threats elicit alarm calls in African elephants. And more recently, we've finished a paper comparing the alarm calls to bees to their alarm call to humans. So we played bee sounds in one experiment, and then we took the threatening sound of Samburu warriors coming through the bush, chanting and dancing as if they were going off for a hunt. And we played those to elephants. And the difference between the humans and the bees was very significant. So they had an alarm call to humans, and they had an alarm call to bees, but they were different. And when we replayed the alarm calls to humans, to elephants, there was no head shaking. There was no sort of, you know, bunching and running away. They just ran quietly and as quickly as they could, because they distinguished between two different levels of threat in the environment. So this is the sort of response to humans. They run quickly, of course, but there's no head shaking, no dusting, nothing like that. So how does this relate to a plan to help keep elephants out of farmers' crops? Well, I spent quite a bit of time designing and thinking up a way of how do we get elephants to shake bees and wake up bees. And I came up with a design for a beehive fence. And so this is a classic beehive fence. We hang beehives between two posts, and the beehives are hung every 10 metres around the entrance to a farmer's field. And they're very high off the ground to stop animals and cattle walking into them. And they have a small thatched roof at the top to stop the sun burning the bees. And up the post, we have some iron sheets to stop the honey badgers coming and attacking the beehives. And then in between each beehive is a strong piece of wire, not electrified, but it just connects one beehive to the next, to the next, to the next. And this goes all the way around to the outside of the farm on the inside of the posts. So if an elephant tries to push through between those two beehives, both beehives swing on either side and several down the line, because they're all connected. So you can have up to 3 beehives swinging on either side. So not every hive has to be occupied, but you need a certain percentage of occupation to make the system successful. And we work very closely with communities building these beehive fences, always engaging the women, because the women are often the ones working in the farm. In some tribes — we have 43 tribes in Kenya — some tribes are not that comfortable with women harvesting honey, but most of the tribes are very comfortable with women working all day in the fields. So they are the hardest workers without doubt, and certainly not at all the least scary. I mean, some of these women are not to be messed with. If I was an elephant, I would run away from these two. They're very, very strong, these women. These are the Turkana tribe that I did my PhD with. The lady on the left is actually still wearing skins, and you know, that's just been beaten into a cloth wear. And they wear these fabulous necklaces, which represents their layer of society. And these two ladies are married with all those necklaces. So fantastic people to work with. We do all sorts of training workshops, building beehives. We have two different hives that we're using at the moment. This is one Kenyan top bar hive. Of course, we're training the farmers how to maintain the hives and look after them. And we can use all sorts of different hives. This is the Kenyan top bar hive. We're using the more modern Langstroth hive as well. And you can even use the traditional hives. This is log beehives. So it's not really the hive that matters, it's the bees. So it doesn't, you know, whichever hive is more appropriate for that community. Some communities already have log beehives. Then that's perfect. We just say, well, let's take them down from your trees and put them around the farms. So I've published some work from my study up in northern Kenya in African Journal of Ecology, if you want to read it. But I just want to tell you more about my recent project, which is down next to Tsavo East National Park. So we moved down to this area because this is a higher area of conflict for agriculture than Samburu. Samburu still has a lot of pastoralism. It's still quite in balance with a lot of the elephants up there. But down in the rest of Kenya, the development has been much more rapid. And next to Tsavo National Park, there's a very strong, intense area of human-elephant conflict. Now, Tsavo is very important. It's our largest elephant population, 12,000 elephants in this whole area. We share that ecosystem with Amboseli as well, and Umkhamazi, which is in northern Tanzania. And this is home to our last great tuskers in East Africa. This is what a great tusker is. This is Marembo. A great tusker is represented by each tusk weighing more than 100 pounds. So he weighed 240 pounds, I think, for both his tusks. He actually died naturally. They found his skull from an aerial reconnaissance, and his skull had rotted. His entire flesh had rotted off naturally, and his tusks were still embedded in his skull. This is very rare. Mostly, you know, these get stolen. But Marembo died naturally. But there are other elephants in the area who are still out there. These elephants are incredibly special. There are 11 left at the moment. And this is one called Satao. I don't know if any of you heard of him. He was possibly the greatest tusker in terms of a weight. And he was poached last year, unfortunately. We lost him in May 2014. There are two females left with tusks of a similar size. This is one of them who I was lucky to see last year. So these are the great tuskers of Tsavo. We cannot let these iconic last individuals go. And they represent a phenomenal gene pool that once was, you know, before the great poaching outbreak in the 70s and 80s. So there's a huge amount of interest in protecting these elephants, and also there's a huge amount of pressure on them as agriculture develops around the edges of the park. So last year I finished building my Elephants and Bees Research Centre down in Tsavo. Some of this funding came from the St. Andrews Prize, which was very gratefully received. I started a project there in 2009, but we only really started developing this project site in 2012. And after about a year of working there and building lots of beehive fences, we knew we needed an actual research centre. Because there was so much going on. There's so much intricacies in what's happening with the elephants in the area. So we built this research centre in order to have a stream of students and volunteers to come and help me, because it really was just getting too much for one person to do on their own. So this centre is fantastic. We now have students from all around Kenya coming to help me. We have training workshops for our beehive fence farmers from different villages that come in. And these interns really have enlivened the project. These are mostly students from Kenyatta University, Nairobi University, some from overseas. We've had one girl from Oxford already, which is nice. Hopefully we'll get more from some international universities. And these students all get their individual projects to work on. And they've been helping us build the beehive fences in this area. And so I'm just going to tell you a bit about that data. So this is a map of the village, the study area. We're using this as a model. So using one small village of about 150 households to test out this beehive fence theory really in great detail. So we've mapped the front line of farms. This is what I call the front line. It's like a war zone. So these are the front farms where the elephants come in. And all of the green farms are permanent farms. And you'll see a little red line. Those of you who aren't colorblind, you'll see a little red line around the outside of the farms which we're protecting. The grey farms are temporary farms. They pop up every 2 to 4 years. So we don't protect those because there's no one actually living there. So those are just a shadow of other farms that do come and go over the years. So the green farms are what we call the frontline farms, people who are absolutely dealing with elephants on a weekly basis. Some of our beehive fence farmers. And this is where the elephants come in from. They're crossing that road, coming straight in from Sava East at night time. This is a photo from one of our camera traps that we got just a few weeks ago, 22nd of March, I think. So this is one of our crop raiding elephants inside the farm. And we spend a lot of time monitoring with the farmers. The farmers are all engaged. They have their own data sheets. They help us fill in the data sheets. And we go and talk to them, collect data, help with a bit of maintenance, just to see how this system is working. And these are the types of data sheets that we collect. So you have the map of the farm. On the left-hand side is one of our earlier ones from 2012, and on the right-hand side, one from last year, just to show you that the arrows represent where the elephants are coming in. So we have dozens and dozens and dozens of sheets like this. As elephants approach the farm, see the beehive fence, walk around the beehive fence, and off again into another area. So on the right-hand side there, you see two different elephants approaching the farm, dividing and conquering as they like, but they didn't get in. So you can see even in more detail that some of the elephants approach in between the hives. They back off, try again, back off, and then they're like, oh, and then they just walk off. They sort of give up, you know, after a few attempts. And this is really exciting to see data like this. Now, this is a one-acre farm, and what we realized that for 1 acre, having a beehive every 10 meters was quite a lot. It was like 24, 25 beehives. It was getting a bit expensive, and also our occupation level was never really above 50%. So we decided to remove every other beehive.
Do you get honey?
Of course, yeah, absolutely. So we removed every other beehive and replaced it with a dummy hive in order to spread the beehives out, but still create this network of connectivity. So this is an example of a dummy beehive. So it looks like a beehive from a distance. It's sort of tricking the elephants. But even if they tried to push through that beehive, there's a real beehive on one side of them. So we've massively increased our percentage rate of occupation and reduced the cost of the hive. So we're getting a bit more of a balance in terms of cost and implementation. So just going to show you some latest data from our project. This is looking at 150 crop raiding elephants in 63 different events across our 13 trial farms in Kenya. And on the left-hand side, you can see out of those elephants, 108 were deterred from going into our beehive fence protected farms. Some of them did enter the control area, which is non-protected, directly next to our beehive fence protected farm. So that's part of our control experiment. So we had a couple that broke the beehive fence, but they didn't actually go into the farm. So maybe the bees deterred them. And then the others really walked all the way around the beehive fences and did not go in. We did, however, have 23 elephants that did break through in all of that time. So I was really interested to say, well, how come those 23 succeeded? You know, what's going on? Because this is very important. And sometimes you find that the wire has simply just been dropped on the floor. Once a lady had taken it for a washing line. So I was like, well, that's not great, because then you've just had elephants in your farm. So she's like, oh, yeah, sorry. You know, took her washing down and put it back on the fence. So there's a few glitches like that that happen, and this is real life experiments. You know, there's all sorts of things that happen. Occasionally a post will have fallen down in the rains and they haven't put it back up and the elephants just walk over. So there's all sorts of reasons why they might break in. But one of the key things I've looked at is that it's all about the occupation of the hive. So in the 17 beehives that were involved in these successful breakthroughs, only 5 cases were breakthroughs happening where there was an occupied hive. This is in almost 3 years of work. So this is a tiny proportion. Those elephants made a run for it through those occupied hives. So occupation of hives is absolutely key to this whole method working. If those beehive fences were empty, I think the elephants would habituate to that eventually, but it's about the bees coming out. And of course, this is what it's all about, is, you know, having these beehive fences protecting the farms and providing the next benefit level, which is the honey production from these beehive fences, and getting farmers engaged in that creativity of another product from their land. And it's also another product from a different level of land. So you're not needing extra land like people growing chilies or people growing buffer zones. You need more land for that. Beehive fences are hanging above your existing land. They're taking another layer of productivity from the farm. So this is very, very important, not only for, you know, the pollination of the crops, but also for the actual income for the farmers. And this income is genuinely what's motivating the maintenance of the fences. Because elephants are not coming in every day. They say they do, but they don't. They come in like twice a month or something. So in between that, you need maintenance of that fence and you need motivation. And this is what's key to the project, is what we have is called elephant-friendly honey. And there's beautiful honey being produced in Sava. I bought one jar with me. Highly illegal to bring this into England, actually, because it hasn't been pasteurized. So this is raw, organic, and unheated honey. It's the most beautiful thing in the world. And in order to get it into England, we have to heat it, pasteurize it, and basically make it non-organic. So I refuse to do that. So it gets sneaked in my luggage just to show you what it's all about. So this is the most stunning honey. You won't believe what it tastes like. I'm very happy for you to taste it. It's very, very special. And we give the farmer a very good rate. We buy it straight from him, from the farm. We don't own the honey. He owns the beehive fence. We buy it back off him. And we pay above market rate for it. And then we sell the honey for a lot of money as well. So it's a very, we increase how much money we're making from the honey. It goes back into the project. So we're doing all sorts of research, looking at occupation in relation to rainfall. This is all about keeping the balance of how these beehive fences work. What you can see here is the black line is rainfall, and the bars are hive occupation. On the top is the Kenyan top bar hive, those ones that we're making ourselves, and on the bottom are the Langstroth hives, more typical of the British beehive that you're used to here. We get much better occupation on the Langstroth hive because the wax combs are embedded in the frames. I don't know how many people are beekeepers here, but they really attract bees very quickly. But the key thing I wanted to show you is that as the rainfall arrives, the bees arrive. So we get high rainfall, high occupation of hives, and at that time, that's when the crops are growing because there's been rainfall. So we get good hive protection for the crops as the crops are growing. And then as you see, the occupation starts to decrease as the rainfall drops off. That's also when the crops are harvested. So we have less hive protection from elephants, but there's also no crops anymore. So we do get a few more breakthroughs of the beehive fence in the dry season, but there's nothing to eat. So the farmers are much less distressed by having an elephant break through the beehive fence because there's no damage generated. So these are some of our elephants, some of our families that are living now more successfully with elephants. And we actually have a lot of work engaging the whole community and doing competitions with the kids at the school. And much before I knew the theme of this topic, this is actually our T-shirt strapline, Living in Harmony with Elephants, which is very appropriate for the discussions this weekend. So this is how we're getting everyone in the community to just see that by having this additional benefit line, you can actually live more successfully. And we've seen, there's one graph just showing you the attitude change. The two projects on the left-hand side both have beehive fences, and the two on the right-hand side do not. And this is simply a graph of perception of how the farmers feel they're able to live with elephants. So we've really managed to halve their negativity towards elephants. So it's a perception that they can live better with them, as well as the actuality of it. And of course, the impact of these beehive fences, there's so much we're still studying. We're doing pollination baseline surveys. How are they pollinating the natural environment now? I have a wonderful postdoc, Dr. Flora Namu from the local university, and she's helping me for the next 2 years to really do pollination understanding, how the honeybees are going to impact local pollinators, butterflies, other honeybees, solitary bees, carpenter bees. So this is really important. And of course, we're also trying to find out what the bees are living on to make sure that we have enough in the environment, and also that they're not going to be pollinating invasive species. So we are lucky to find the most beautiful, pristine environment here. We only have 3 invasive species in the whole area. This is my friend on the left, Anne Powers, who's one of the best ethnobotanists in Kenya, and our local herbalist on the right-hand side, who's helping us identify local names for plants and what they're used for traditionally for medicine as well as for the bees. And he says, if you see a bee on a plant, that means a human can eat it, which is interesting. We're not going to test that exactly ourselves, but he's pretty wacky, this guy. So we take his advice with a pinch of salt usually, but we're developing this really fantastic herbarium, the first time there's been any herbarium anywhere in this part of Kenya. We've also been submitting some of our specimens to the National Museum in Nairobi. We went in to submit one sheet, and the most recent sheet that was there was from David Sheldrick from 1964, who is the founder of Save National Park. So, you know, the museum is really lagging behind in Kenya. So we're able to kind of provide some more specimens, which is really wonderful. This is a very new project. We haven't got any answers yet, but we're doing a really nice survey to try and understand the whole ecosystem and how our beehive fences is going to impact this. We think it's going to be only positive, but we need to make sure we're not out-competing some local insects. And I'm really happy to say my project's now been embedded into the conservation and management strategy for the elephant in Kenya. This is the government management plan for Kenya. They even put our photo on the front page, which I think is really significant. And so this is something that's going to be worked on with government support for the next 10 years. And we're seeing beehive fences pop up everywhere. I can hardly keep up with it now. All of our data is free online, so people are popping up in Uganda, Tanzania, Botswana, Mozambique. I've been a consultant now to two countries, Mozambique and Botswana, helping them set up beehive fences. Just come back from South Africa. There's another project happening with the peace parks in Mozambique I'll be going to this year. And it's really very exciting, and every country is slightly different, so different ideas of evolution of the beehive fence, different structures, different concepts. And just last year, again, thanks to the St. Andrews Prize, we've had a start of a preliminary work in Sri Lanka. This is very exciting. This is very blue sky research. We have no idea if it's going to work there. We've got a different elephant species completely. We have a totally different bee species. The bees are less aggressive, apparently. They're much smaller. They have different behavior. But you know what? We're trying. And we have a great PhD student there for the next 3 years from Australia who's helping me do this. And we always say, look, it may not work very well because the bees are less aggressive. But even if they stop 20% of the elephants, and we're introducing beekeeping to these rural communities, what harm is there? And beekeeping is such a strong motivator for communities to look after the environment that we're really not that worried if it's not hugely successful in Sri Lanka. But I think it will stop some of them because it's actually a physical barrier as well. And it's just what proportion. You know, in Kenya, we're 82% at the moment success rate, which is way more than I ever thought. Sri Lanka, sure, it might be 20, might be 50%. But we're willing to try it, and with some extra support, it's been fantastic. So, you know, we started to see projects pop up in India now. These are two independent articles, not related to me, who've seen the idea and have started to adapt it for Indian circumstances. And a lot of this help sort of moving into Asia, having this very blue sky thought, has been helped by the St. Andrews Prize, which is very grateful for that funding support. And I was also lucky to win the Future for Nature Award in 2013 and meet Dr. Jane Goodall, which was a huge highlight of my life. And that's Saba Douglas Hamilton on the left, you may know from Big Cat Diary. So this is very special to have this kind of support, funding, as well as kind of emotional support from conservationists who say, you know what, this is a great idea. You know, it may not be 100% successful, but even electric fences are not 100% successful. And electric fences are hideous things, and they cost money, and they're constant reminder of us dividing ourselves up from nature. So yes, the beehive fences may only be 80% effective, but the honey production, the pollination, the goodwill, the attitude change of the communities is everything. And so I'm really happy that this is being recognised and hopefully, you know, going to be developing and expanding across Africa. So as I said just at the beginning, we've got a very short video. I know I've spoken quite a lot, but it only came in last night. So this is my Disney colleagues who have been out with me for 8 years in a row. And Disney has been a phenomenal supporter right from the beginning when they thought this idea was totally crazy, and they were willing to, they donated $15,000 in 2006 just to say, okay, well, this sounds utterly crazy, but we do have Dumbo the elephant at Disney, so maybe we should be doing something about this. So they supported me when the concept was completely new, and they've kept going every year, $25,000 a year for the last 8 years. So they've been really solid supporters. And now they've developed a whole demonstration at Disney's Animal Kingdom. You get told all about this when you arrive. Last year, they had 10.8 million people coming through Disney to that particular area. So, you know, some people might say, well, you're being supported by a zoo that has elephants. Is, you know, what's the ethics of that? Well, actually, all their elephants were rescued from circuses in America. So they do have African elephants at their zoo, which has its own controversy, but they simply can't be released, those individuals. They're quite disturbed elephants, really, from their years of circus training. So they're trying to do their bit to help wild African elephants in the wild. And so you'll see a shameless plug for them at the end of the film from me. But I hope you enjoy it, and it's just 5 minutes, so it'll give you a taster of the vision of what we have out in Kenya, and then I'll just finish at the end. Thanks.
In these times, wherever African elephants are found, there are also plenty of people nearby, and it can be very difficult for the two species to live in harmony. One source of great conflict is crop raiding by elephants.
I was nearly to give up growing here because of elephants.
Nzumu is an important leader and farmer in the Sagala community, very near to the Tsavo National Park. His family has been farming there for generations.
Elephant comes and destroy everything.
Elephants are herbivores. So when they run across a local farm, they cannot resist the impulse to take advantage of the meal. And in the process, they can wreak havoc on farms, trampling and eating everything in their paths.
The elephants in Kenya roam free. They're not confined to national parks. They're not behind fences. And so the elephants migrate through the landscape. And as they do migrate, they come across small farms. And these small farms are being crop raided by elephants and causing a huge amount of human-elephant conflict.
A single crop raiding event by a large elephant family can wipe out an entire year's crop for a local human family. So these farmers, they have to protect themselves. But the result can sometimes be fatal for both people and elephants. The trick is to find non-violent ways to protect farms from elephants. Enter the African honeybee. Yes, the Save the Elephants Conservation Group and Disney are using tiny honeybees to help both people and elephants in Kenya.
Here in our project in Sagala, we have a deterrent system for stopping human-elephant conflict. We've discovered that elephants are scared of bees.
It all started when conservationists from Save the Elephants and local Samburu tribesmen were walking through the bush in northern Kenya. The conservationists noticed a stand of trees that had been decimated by the elephants, all except for one. What's up with that, they wondered. The local tribesmen told the conservationists that there was a beehive in that tree and that elephants are afraid of bees. To make sure this was true, scientists from Save the Elephants and from Disney conducted bee playback experiments to confirm that elephants really do run away from bees and also see if they communicate about bees by warning other nearby elephants.
Looks like there's a family over here to the right.
Here's how the experiments work. First, we find elephants resting under trees. Second, we drive around the elephants and carefully place hidden microphones to record their rumble vocalizations. Third, we place a wireless speaker near them. When we're all ready, we play the bee sounds through the speaker, film their behavior, and the microphones pick up their rumble vocalizations. Well, our instincts turned out to be right. Elephants not only run away from bees and shake their heads to knock the bees away, but they also produce a special rumble that warns other elephants. When elephants hear this rumble alarm call, they run away and shake their heads just as if the bees were there. Armed with this knowledge, Save the Elephants has been constructing beehive fences. Yes, fences made of actual beehives around farmers' crops. Hearing the bees and occasionally getting stung keeps the elephants away.
Here we have a demonstration beehive fence, which is around Douglas's farm in Sagala. And he has 12 beehives and 12 dummy beehives all around his 2-acre farm here. And what it is one beehive is connected to the other, to the other, to the other, all the way around the boundary. If an elephant was to approach this farm, he's going to hit the wire on his chest, and it's going to cause the beehives on either side of him to swing. And you see how badly the beehives are swinging. That will release the bees, if there were bees in that hive. And the bees come out and really disturb the elephant, either stinging him or chasing him away. And we know from our experiments with playing bee sounds to elephants that they run away. So this is a deterrent system that's stopping elephants breaking into these farms and reducing human-elephant conflict.
Today, Joseph and I are out on one of the farms today helping farmers with some maintenance of the beehives.
The beehive fences are relatively cheap to build, but they're also incredibly easy to maintain. And this is one of the reasons why the fence works so well. The farmers are managing their own deterrent system.
The elephant came to my farm, but they didn't get in my farm because of this beehive fence. After they saw the beehive fence, they went back running away and went with another way.
You can see the change beginning, and that change is what is like we are looking forward to, because it's a long-term thing.
Bees help people in many ways. Two big ways are pollination of plants and providing honey. But their sting is something we fear and try to avoid. But even their stinging capabilities can help people too. By using the sting of bees as a threat to elephants, we can keep them away from farmers' crops. And the farmers still get the usual benefits too, pollination and honey.
This is our elephant-friendly honey. It's jarred very simply, and it's a symbol of all the work that's gone into the project. So the beehive fences that have been well maintained, the farmers which have successfully kept elephants out of the Shamba, and it's now being jarred in our Elephants and Bees Research Centre, ready for sale around the country, back in Nairobi and in many homes and houses around Kenya. And this is really very exciting for us to get to this end product.
It's been really eye-opening for me to see the pieces that we're doing back there, how it transfers out here to help these guys and help the human-elephant conflict and with the elephants.
This is what it's all about, you know, with the beehive fences, protecting the farms from the crop-raiding elephants so that people can live in harmony with elephants, so they're a little bit better alongside elephants.
We have this interesting partnership with Disney. They have been instrumental in joining our team. They've come on board and they've brought not only funding through the Disney Worldwide Conservation Fund, but also expertise. And it's the expertise which we're so grateful for with Dr. Joseph Soltis and his colleagues. They've helped us do a number of detailed research, not only in Disney's Animal Kingdom, but out in Kenya as well. They've provided constant support, they've provided education materials for our schools, they've provided this whole network of knowledge. We're so grateful for that, and the support and the momentum that it's given us means that the project is expanding rapidly. So we hope this relationship will be going for many years to come. Update that data at the end, it's slightly out of date now, but it's quite nice. They tell me they're going to put that in those in the rooms in the Disney's hotel to show people what they're doing as part of their, you know, this is corporate social responsibility for Disney, which is really fantastic that, you know, we're one of their key projects. So just wanted to let you know that we have a lot of publications. This is one of my aims as a scientist. I find it very difficult writing papers in a tent. But occasionally I get myself back to Nairobi and try and work up and put my data onto publications. I think this is vital. So if you're interested in reading any of our papers, we've got some popular articles as well as actual real science. You're welcome to download anything from the website. We have a very open door policy. Everything's free. Everything can be downloaded. The manuals are all here. If you'd like to read one of our manuals, you're very welcome. This is the hard copy, but the PDF is free online. And I think this is why so many people are starting the projects, because we're very open source about our information. So, you know, you're very welcome to come and have a flick through. This is how to build your own beehive fence if you have problems with elephants in Sussex. we hope to get a bit more funding to just get this translated into probably 4 or 5 different languages, now that we've just sort of perfected that, really, and we know that it's working. And of course, it's going to be in Sengalese in about 2 years when we've done our Sri Lankan beehive fences that are all being built at the moment. And you can also, anyone wants to fund or sponsor a beehive fence, we're very, very open to some extra funding. We ask for £60 per beehive, which helps include all the material for building the beehive fence. You know, it's $100 basically just to support a beehive with all the material, the labour that goes into it. So if you fancy giving a, you know, present to one of your grandkids or your, you know, your family, it'd be really very welcome. We're also trying to raise money for a new vehicle because we have that one green car and my ancient Land Rover that has broken down 18 times in the last 4 months, literally. So we're kind of looking for funding for these big items such as vehicles. So if anyone has any cash up their sleeve, you're very welcome to support the project. And finally, just to thank all of our donors and all of our support team, and my supervisor at Oxford, Professor Fritz Wohlrath, is still helping me, you know, 10 years later. He's still very much our champion of this project. And of course, Dr. Ian Douglas Hamilton, who is the mentor and absolute icon of Save the Elephants. I hope you're lucky enough one day to get to hear him speak. He's a really wonderful speaker. He comes to England usually once a year to give talks. His daughter, Saba Douglas Hamilton, is now doing more talks as well in the UK. So if you ever see her advertising a talk, I highly recommend it. They're very passionate speakers. And if anyone has any more questions about this, I'm very happy to talk to you about it afterwards. I'm trying to use up my time so I don't get thousands of questions, but there's 20 minutes left, which is quite good timing. So if anyone has any questions, I'm here to answer any.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, I think you'll agree that we've heard something really visionary and innovative. And that you probably learn more about elephants this morning than you've learned, certainly for several years, and that nobody's a specialist on elephants. So we've got some time for a few questions to Lucy. And I think we've got another microphone. I can take one microphone round. Luke.
Yeah, my name is Luke Sala. I'm interested, did you make an audiogram of elephants? You know what an audiogram is?
What do you mean in that sense? Sorry.
Sensitivity to the frequency, like humans, you can between 3,000 hertz and 30,000 hertz, you make a graph.
Yes.
Of what you hear. Very easy to do on the computer. But do you have that for the elephants?
I don't have that here with me, but of course there's plenty of data that has that in many papers. So elephants can rumble down to about 12 hertz. So it goes from 12 hertz all the way up to 18,000, I think. So it's, I don't have that information.
Okay. Then I was interested in your Genghis Khan group.
Okay.
Because are there any indication why that happens? And I'm thinking about hooligans or ISIS caliphate fighters joining up 17 to work outside of the normal family relationship and become what we see there.
Yes. Yeah, so this is common, actually. We see this in conflict situations where elephants, particularly bull elephants, club together. It's a safety in numbers thing. In Zakuma National Park in Chad, where they were being machine gunned down from helicopters, there were 3,000 elephants and they went down to 400 very quickly. There were photographs from the air, conservationists taking photos of 1,200 elephants clubbed together like that. So this is what elephants do when they're in danger zones. And it's what zebras do and impalas do when they're on the savannah, you know, looking out for lions and other threats. So this is a sign of conflict when you see elephants like this, particularly bull elephants. So this is going outside of their normal behavioral setup. And it's always a sign of conflict. So people sometimes send me photos of big groups of elephants, and I immediately go, where was that? Because that's not normal. You know, it's not a happy situation when you see bull elephants clubbing together. But they've learned, of course, you know, it's incredibly intimidating. So they're more likely, they're splitting the risk up by being all together and crop raiding. So this is a sign of conflict always. I wish I had more photos to show you of that, because we have these massive photos of, you know, congregations in danger zones.
I mean, I'm sure you'll know this work, but I was reading about, it was published recently, about how they can distinguish the sound of the voices of those two different tribes and distinguish also whether, from the ones that hunt them, whether it's young people or women, mm-hmm. and they're not a threat. I mean, that's a lot of distinguishing of human voice, isn't it? I just think it's so wondrous that they're so clever. And what worries me is... Mm-hmm. that they will get clever about your beehives. I think they'll probably find a way to get in. They may have some very brave elephant that goes ahead and leads the way. There was another thing that I wanted to say. It seems that not all of elephants are opportunistic crop raiders, because that one that you tracked, that tracked from his place where he lived and went over through the farm area, he didn't seem to be a crop raider. All he really needed was that his road was kept clear for him. Do you know what I mean? He didn't seem to wander off.
Actually, no, he was crop raiding, so that was an hour position through those farms. So he was there for an hour, and then he'd crop raid another hour. He was crop raiding very happily all through there. But not too much, no. I mean, it's entirely likely that they put that farming area right over his corridor. So he's learnt crop raid as he's realised his corridor has been taken over. There could be all sorts of reasons why he wanted to go to that second forest, most likely nutritional. And also it was an area that was connected to Lewa Downs. I don't know if you know Lewa very well, but it's got a lot of females. So there's that connectivity to females down there. So maybe as he comes into Must, he might be looking for females that will have come up into that forest. So there's all sorts of reasons why he might be going through that area. But those farms are new, relatively, probably the last 40, 50 years. But the other question about effectively, yes, so this is a very interesting study that's been done by Amboseli. We've actually done some research ourselves recently, which is sitting on this laptop and unpublished, is that elephants can distinguish between voices of different tribes and within the tribe, within different sexes, between females and males. It's extraordinary. And so this one study looking at the Kamba tribe and the Maasai tribe, the Kambas are agriculturalists and the Maasai are pastoralists. So they were more fearful to the Kamba voices, which is very interesting because there's more conflict with them than the Maasai who are pastoralists with cattle and everything. And we're looking at the same between Samburu and Turkana voices. Our Turkana, who I showed you those fearsome ladies, they are real killers of elephants, whereas the Samburu are not so fierce. So we've also seen some distinctions. So that will be a good paper when I can get enough time to publish that. They can distinguish accents. Basically, yes, as scientists, it's very difficult to say they're speaking a language. We're not allowed to say things like that, but we're looking at a great deal of complexity in their consciousness, that they can differentiate between subtleties in human language. And this is between men speaking. So this is the female-male, you can sort of more comprehend there's different levels of frequencies in our voices between men and women. That's sort of more understandable. But to understand the accents and the different tribal languages of different men, different warriors of the same age classes, that is exceptional. And the final question was about habituation, of how clever they are, and maybe they can work out how to get around these beehive fences. Without doubt, they would get around an actual beehive fence. But bees, African bees, I doubt very much they ever habituate. If you've ever been stung by an African bee, you will know how extremely painful it is. But the distinction about them is that as they sting, their sting gets embedded in the skin and it pulls the venom sac out of their body. The bee actually dies. And that pulling of the venom sac releases a pheromone. And that pheromone explodes into the air. And the other bees read that as a symbol. And they absolutely flock to that site where the pheromone's been released and sting multiple times. And every sting multiplies the effect. So you end up with what possibly could be 10,000 bees stinging you. And this is what the elephants are scared of. And no one is going to habituate to that. I've been stung by 25 bees at one time and almost died. And I can't imagine what it'd be like to be stung 10,000 times. But these elephants know this, that's for sure, as they're intelligent enough to have been stung once or twice. Now, in my very first playback as a young PhD student up in Samburu, I played bee sounds to 17 different families, and one family didn't run at all, didn't even blink, didn't even move. And I was like, what on earth is going on here? No reaction at all, apart from a slight head shift as they heard something come on, and then they went back to feeding. So I was confused by that, and I thought, well, this is interesting. So some elephants may never have had an experience of bees before. They may need to learn that. And what was also interesting when I looked at that video is that there was no matriarch in that group. The oldest female there was 20. So there's a repository of knowledge that goes with those older females that we need to keep. And so what we've seen with some of our other work is that the young calves do not have an instinctive fear of bee. It's a learnt behaviour. So as a one-year-old calf, they have no response whatever to bees. In the videos, we can see them reacting far slower. They're like, ooh, what's happening? Mom's getting a bit panicked. And then as they get to age 3 or 4, they start to react at the same time as the adults. And then when they get to sort of, 9 or 10, they're reacting equally as fast, if not before the mum, because their hearing's better. So, this is what we're seeing. It's not instinctive. It is actually a learnt behaviour. Very difficult to prove that scientifically, but we've definitely observed that in our work. So I'm hesitant to say I don't think they'll ever habituate to bee stings, whereas they do habituate to electric fences, because that's a sting and it's a current and it's over. And we've seen male elephants pushing young males into an electric fence. And the young male gets thrown on his side, grounds and shorts the whole electric fence, and the other elephants walk over him. And this guy has left that. And yeah, Maybe, right,
can,
yeah.
Can we keep...
Have you, when you're setting up the dummy hives, have you ever tried... Have you ever tried putting in automatically triggered sound systems and to play back the sound of angry bees?
Yeah, very good question. No is a short answer, but it's the next logical step. I'm glad you didn't say, why don't you just play bee sounds, because they would habituate for certain to that. But it's an excellent idea to have playbacks from the dummy beehives. The only issue with that, academically fascinating, but in reality, never going to be a realistic deterrent because of the electronics required. And so this was very much part of the whole concept, is how do everyday farmers, and we're talking millions of farmers, live with this. So, you know, asking people to have iPods and solar panels and things to play that bee sound is not realistic. But academically, it would be very interesting to test that. I think it would work brilliantly, having the combination. And maybe that's appropriate for things like lodges, you know, that don't want lots of beehives around, but might want just that odd burst of deterrent. So, yeah.
I just want to say, sideways, I found your talk inspiring. And also the sideline, how it's an antidote to cynicism. And it made me think of the inspiration towards the social good. But the question I want to ask is, I was thinking, you've got the poachers. They're gangs of delinquent human bulls. And they're a big conflict. And I was wondering if there was a permeation of your work that in some way the attitude of the farmers is affected. Does this affect the politicians? And can you do anything about... is there a build-up of attitudes toward these delinquent human bulls? And can you affect any of them? You know, at the level of macro politics.
Yes, thank you very much. Just tying in the connection between, you know, human-elephant conflict and poaching, what we have seen, very rare actually for a farmer to be a poacher, and the reason for that is because they will kill elephants, that's different, but actually killing an elephant to poach the ivory on the spot, they are wildlife service incredibly aggressive. So if they found a dead elephant in your farm with tusks missing, you would be beaten up until you could hardly walk. So we have a very aggressive response to these things. But what it is doing is it's reducing the farmers becoming more tolerant to elephants in these communities. So they're therefore less tolerant of housing and covering up for poachers within their community. And we get particularly Somalis, I'm afraid, Somali camel herders who are infiltrating these communities, living around for a few months and then poaching elephants. And our communities often get blamed and they get very irate. It's a huge conflict. The Somalis are a big issue in Kenya. We have 4 million of them, I think, at the moment. And so this is very, very significant, that increasing tolerance for elephants within these communities reduces their tolerance for having poachers hanging out around them. And they're much more likely to tell the wildlife service. There's also a greater trust building between our wildlife service and these particular villages, which I'm finding fascinating. So the wildlife service is much more responsive now to when they get a call for conflict, because they know this community is trying something. They're doing something for themselves. They're not just sitting back waiting for the rangers to turn up. So when our farmers call the KWS, there's a huge response now because they're being called less, which is wonderful. So it means the rangers have now got more time to do anti-poaching. But when they do call, they're actually getting a better response from the wildlife service. So that development, that relationship development, is really helping. And that I see as a huge benefit that could spread around the country. But this, the fact of, you know, there's more eyes on the ground now to do anti-poaching. And actually, our farmers really quite like elephants now. And they come and tell me, they say, you know what? We saw them eating this tree. I didn't know they ate this tree. And I'm like, oh, what did you see? He said, oh, well, I brought my son and we sat and watched this elephant for 20 minutes and we were looking at... I mean, they never did that. They would just scream and run and throw things and that was it. Now they're actually sitting and watching elephants. And just, you know, that harmony is coming back into it. So that's a slow process. It's not something easy to measure, but it's certainly an improvement at that level.
Yes, hello, my name is Peter Hardwick. Just recently I saw a David Attenborough documentary film about elephants. One particular feature of it, I found it very, very moving. It was a family of elephants and they came across the skeleton of a dead elephant and they stopped there for several hours and two or three of them actually picked up the skull of the dead elephant with their trunks and held it. It was very, very moving to see that behaviour. Obviously, that association that they had with a dead element, Another question is, can you just say something about the breeding habits of elephants? Can any male go with any female, or do you have a dominant male that would have a tribe of females? How does the breeding pattern operate?
Sure. So just briefly about the skull recognition. This is fascinating. We've known that elephants not only grieve, but they also recognize the bones of their conspecifics. And what's even more interesting is that they spend more time on the bones of elephants that they knew than on elephant bones that they didn't know. And this is extraordinary, that they actually recognize, there's some sense of recognition that this is an elephant carcass that they knew one time. And that's some of the work being done by Cynthia Moss and Amber Selly. Fascinating that they can tell different bones. So when you bring bones in from a different area, they don't spend as much time on those elephant bones. It's not just the smell of the remnant smell of an elephant carcass. It's actually the individual, we think. Again, quite hard to be sure about that, but it's just fascinating that they really do grieve their dead. And then the question just about male elephants breeding. So males come into estrus about once a year for anything from a month to 2.5 months. It's a state of really heightened testosterone in their bodies. They lose a lot of body weight. They do an extreme amount of walking, looking for estrus females. And females only come into estrus once every 4 to 4.5 years. And they only come into estrus for about a week. So these bulls are in a complete state of panic that in their 6 weeks they're not going to find an estrus female. And so what happens in that state is that they will be walking a lot. They'll be going group to group to group, looking for females, listening for rumbles. As soon as they hear a distance rumble, they'll go walking, find that group. They test every female. And of course, what happens is younger bulls join that bull in must, and they come along behind, and they're sort of keeping an eye out for an estrus female that the big bull might come across. And so these females get very excited when these big estrus must bulls come in. And if a female is on the edge of coming into estrus, the presence of him alone in his huge testosterone state might trigger her estrus to come in, particularly if he hangs around for a couple of hours. And this is extraordinary, that females can suddenly come into estrus because they're so turned on by this huge bull that's appeared. Now, if there's a small window where she comes into estrus maybe 2 hours after the bull's walked away, there could be a younger bull that's been hanging out who suddenly gets a chance to mate. So this is, you know, this is a whole theory of, you know, young bulls actually mating well before their prime. And it's incredibly important for gene pools, of course, that it's not just those dominant males that can breed. So you do get these congregations of bulls, but it's they can be very short-lived relationships. So they might just be together for a month, and then they'll split off again when the bull drops out of must. But at the same time, we've got several papers now showing that there are individual bulls that just like each other, and they will hang out for years and years. And they may be 5-10 kilometres apart for some months, and then they'll be back again. So we know that there are kinships and friendships amongst bulls, irrelevant of the must state, that last for years. So they're not as solitary as people believe, but they do really, it's mostly interacting with females when either the females are in estrus or they're coming into must.
My name's Paul Matony. It makes my heart smile to see this fantastic, what a sweetener for conservation. I mean, you know, and I've been involved in conservation since I was a child, so including the Painted Dogs Project in Zimbabwe.
Yes, yeah, very well.
And, but I want to ask a different sort of question, because it's always for me, I do my own private research work about you're playing a part in the ecosystem. You know, this is, and we often forget about humans playing a part in the ecosystem. And I want to know, if you can answer it, what motivated you to start this work? I know you lived in Africa as a child, but a lot of people did and have. And I just want, this is to do with the link between the conservation work you do and what I would think of as an aspect of your spiritual life. I don't know if you can say anything about that at all,
thanks.
But I want to ask.
Thanks, that's quite a long question, isn't it? I think what's really motivated me, I was brought up in Lesotho, as I said, and both my parents were teachers. So we were lucky to have very long holidays where both of them would be off work. But we also had really no money at all. So both of them were earning local African teacher salaries. So you can imagine how little that was. And we had an old Cortina, Ford Cortina. And we would go off for weeks at a time into national parks as our school holidays, because we didn't have any other sort of money to do anything like go to hotels or go flying anywhere. So we'd just take some tents and we'd go and set up in a park and just explore. And so sort of being brought up in that environment with very liberal-minded, you know, parents. And I really noticed, because we did a lot of driving in our Ford Cortina, we drove all the way through South Africa into Namibia, Botswana, lots of time in Zimbabwe, which was just beautiful then. We couldn't go into Mozambique because of the civil war, but we really explored it, particularly Swaziland as well. Beautiful, beautiful countries. And even at that age, we had so much time sitting around campfires as a family, chatting. And even as a young kid, we all noticed the difference from going from South Africa into the other countries. And it was really stark to go from these fenced off, controlled, expensive parks, and then we'd just go into somewhere like Botswana, which is just this wonderful wilderness with it's only got 1.9 million people in the whole country, and that sense of freedom and connectivity with nature, and being in a campsite with not a single thing in the campsite. You're just told that's the tree where you camp, you know, whereas in South Africa there's plugs for your caravan and there's electricity and there's like movies showing at nighttime, and it's just a horrendous experience actually for me. And to go into these beautiful camps and just be told that that tree is the campsite and we'd just live there. And you'd have elephants and hyenas around your tent at night. And I think that connectivity with nature just fills your soul, doesn't it? When you've been in London for the day and you get back home and you see a park and green trees, you just have this sense of relief. And so I get that buzz from being in nature. And it's, yeah.
Nicholas Pilbrook, thank you for a very moving and inspirational talk. I just, on a more mundane commercial level, I noticed these bee fences are relatively cheap at about £60 or something per hive. But on a dollar a day, that's quite a financial imposition. Mm. And I just wondered if you'd established sources of finance and who, on a larger scale, who is the government behind these projects or who provides the finance for a farm?
Thank you. So there's different levels of beehive fence. The first fence that I showed, which has, one of the traditional, this one. So this fence is made from traditional log beehives that were found from within the community. So basically completely free. The posts, actually we bought those posts, but you can cut and coppice posts. We don't cut whole trees for our posts, we coppice branches. And all of that grass can be bought locally. So for a beehive fence like this, it can cost $45 for an acre, which is even local farmers can afford that amount. Now, this type of beehive fence doesn't produce as much honey, and we don't want to encourage people to cut down any more big trees to make these logs. So these traditional hives, unfortunately, there just simply aren't enough in the country to use these traditional hives for the scale of our project. So we've started moving up to the different, more manufactured hives. So these hives are about £30 all in. And of course, we're reducing the cost of the whole beehive fence by coppicing posts. And then these are the most expensive ones. These are the hives, which are actually, they're $65. And the reason we're starting to use these more is, A, we're getting individual donors to donate them, but also they're making so much more honey that the finances are actually paying back that fence. So if a farmer had to invest in this himself, he would pay that back roughly in 2 years. So it's a sort of manageable microfinance loan if a farmer had to build one himself. But at the moment, we're actually getting, we've had 30 hives donated from the Wildlife Department themselves. And I'm really trying to encourage them to start funding more beehives, because seeing on the side of a beehive donated by Kenya Wildlife Service, the farmers are like, wow, I've actually benefited for the first time ever from the wildlife and the parks. So I'm really encouraging that sort of local corporate social responsibility from the parks, because I think it's a very visual benefit that the farmers can see. And of course, we're not protecting every farm. We're really just doing those frontline farms. So per community, we're looking at maybe 15 to 20 beehive fences in a whole village. So it's not quite as huge a scale as it seems. But yes, we are also getting corporate donors to help, you know, pay £50 for a hive. So all in all, it depends where you are and the scale of the cost of the fence.
Thank you. Well, I mean, you could... I was in St Andrews last year, and you in St Andrews University, the new sort of physics, well, there's this physiology lecture theatre, you can donate a seat, and then you have your name on the back of the seat. And sometimes it says, don't go to sleep, you know, on the back of the sleeve. but more often than not, I'm going to say, you could in fact have donated by somebody at this conference with their photograph on the side of the beehive. And then the person, the local farmer would be able to see, well, this is the person who gave me this thing. I think it's fantastic. Exactly. I'm sure there'll be some takers. Send a digital image.
Yeah. Up there you can see donated by I4 and KWS on that middle hive,
right.
So we can't see it that easily.
I think that's fantastic.
You know, we've written the donor on there. So
we could probably do a whole fence between us.
Wow.
No, that'd be, that's it'd be a good great challenge. Output from the conference.
Yes, it would.
Yeah,
thank
okay.
You.
Well, we'll see how to organise that. Anyway, I'd just like you to join me in thanking Lucy for really inspirational talk.